This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today. Mental illness is in the spotlight this week. President Barack Obama convened a national conference on mental health at the White House on Monday. Speakers included the president, vice president, and secretary of Health and Human Services. Here in Wisconsin, this week's Joint Finance Committee schedule includes a vote on increased funding for comprehensive community services for the mentally ill. That's the last element of Governor Scott Walker's plan to increase community mental health funding by about $16 million. It's in addition to the committee's approval of $12.5 million for the Mendota Mental Health Institute. Walter Locks is Director of Behavioral Health Services for Community Advocates. The Milwaukee-based group helps meet the basic needs of those who are struggling. In March, he spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about the governor's proposal and barriers to care.
There's many reasons why individuals who need mental health services aren't able to get care. For instance, not recognizing that they might benefit from services, access of providers. The individuals that we work with at Community Advocates, many of them are homeless. So there's a physical, geographical barrier in addition to not being able to find a provider and then simply not having insurance.
And would Governor Scott Walker's plan for mental health funding help overcome some of these barriers? Or do you think some of that disconnect between services and people who need it would continue?
So first, I would say I think what the governor did was fantastic. Putting money into mental health services is always a good thing. We've seen a number of reductions over the years, so getting money into services is a good thing. For the population that we see, anyway, at Community Advocates, it's probably not going to have a huge impact because he puts his money, at least for adults, into forensic admission units at Mendota. So that's a state-operated facility. That's not going to be helpful for adults who are homeless. There's services for children, and that's certainly a good thing, but for adults, that's not going to be particularly helpful. And then he put something in called comprehensive community services, $10 million. That's fantastic that he put that in, but individuals need to be on Medicaid in order to be eligible for that. Most people who are homeless don't have Medicaid. So part of what we do is assist them to get benefits. And once they become eligible for Medicaid, then they might be able to take advantage of some of those services.
What about the peer-run respite centers? Are those places where people could go if they're homeless and they need some mental health help?
As I understood that from what was in the governor's budget, the peer-run respite centers would be a step down, if you will, from a current crisis stabilization center. So in Milwaukee, for instance, there are two crisis resource centers, one on the south side and one on the north side. The idea behind the peer-run respite centers, once somebody is sufficiently stabilized, for instance, at one of those resource centers, then they could move to a peer-run respite center. So to the extent that individuals can access the resource centers, I think that that would be helpful, but it's a short-term solution, and I think you want a long-term perspective in addressing any number of different needs, including mental illness. Mental illness is one of many domains that's affected.
And I've heard that half the population that's homeless has a mental health need. Is that correct?
The 2011 point-in-time survey by the Milwaukee Homeless Service System identified 39% of the individuals. I suspect that that's greatly underreported due to stigma around mental illness. So it wouldn't surprise me that it would be more than that. But these are just individuals that identified for themselves whether or not they had a mental illness.
When your staff goes out and tries to assist people who are homeless and who have mental illnesses, what are some of the barriers they encounter in getting that care to that population?
So we have outreach staff, nurses and clinicians, that reach out to homeless individuals both in the shelters and on the street and try to engage with individuals who have a serious mental illness. There's many reasons why individuals don't want to engage with the formal service system. It might be due to stigma. It might be due to paranoia or their psychiatric symptoms. and it might be having had really bad experiences in the past with providers when they have sought services. Others and other individuals also have substance use disorders, so drugs or alcohol, and it's hard to tease out what's causing the issues here. And some places will say you have to go get sober before we'll address the mental health issues. Other places might say get stabilized on your mental health medication before we can address. And that just leaves the person in the middle. So our staff is trying to engage with an individual using a housing first approach so that we just get people into housing. And that starts to build a trust and a rapport with the individual so that they can begin to address not only their mental health needs, but everything else. These are individuals that usually have many chronic medical conditions as well. Some of them have had contact with law enforcement and outstanding municipal violations or whatever the case may be. They might have difficulty in accessing vocational services, whatever it is. So what we try to do is just by getting taking care of their basic needs through housing, getting them someplace that's safe, then we can start to address not just their mental health, but everything else that goes around the entire surround.
And after you get people off the streets and into affordable housing, is that when you could get them on Medicaid? And if so, would the governor's plan then be helpful to the population?
It very well could be. So the individuals that we work with typically don't have benefits. Many of them would be eligible for Social Security due to their psychiatric disability. But that takes a long process. So what we do is provide what's called a safe haven. So it's zero income housing. Individuals are there for about 6 to 9 months on average, depending on the situation, it might be longer. During that time, not only are we providing service coordination, we're also providing benefit advocacy for the individual so that we can get them their disability, as well as coordinating both their behavioral health as well as their medical needs. Once they're able to establish disability with Social Security, then they're able to move on to permanent housing, permanent affordable housing.
And you mentioned that some homeless people have run-ins with the law, and I've read that a lot of people who are incarcerated actually have mental illnesses. Why is that, and why does that seem to be even higher among women and girls?
One of the unfortunate and unintended consequences of deinstitutionalization was the failure to adequately address the capacity of community-based care. So as people left institutions, state institutions, and were told to go get services in the community, and this isn't unique to Milwaukee, this was throughout the country, there wasn't enough capacity to address all of the needs of individuals. So our criminal justice facilities have become the de facto mental health institutions. So individuals who may commit offenses due to their psychiatric symptoms, or due to their behavioral health needs, or as a component of that, end up in the institutions, in the criminal justice institutions. And some people may receive services while they are locked up. Some may not. Some individuals go into jail on their medications, but maybe their medication isn't on the formulary in the jail, and then they're switched. And it takes individuals, many individuals, a few weeks to adjust to a new med. So now you've got people that aren't on the medications that they were taking before once they're in the institutions, and everything just gets kind of jumbled up. And when they come out, not only do you have the stigma of having been incarcerated, you've got the stigma of a mental illness on top of it. Your meds may not be coordinated. You may not have a community provider. You don't have a job. You may not have housing. Life looks pretty chaotic. So it's a pretty tough thing to try to sort through.
What about the governor's plans to increase funding for forensic treatment units? Did this have some kind of evaluation component, and would that help with this incarcerated population?
Well, it might. So what the forensic units end up doing is it's designed for people arrested but not convicted of a crime who are committed to complete a competency evaluation and treatment competency. It's also designed for people convicted of crimes but found not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. So individuals who may commit a crime and are determined to be competent to stand trial wouldn't necessarily go to one of the forensic units. So that's often reserved for individuals with serious mental illness, with serious functional impairments.
So dealing with the populations we've been talking about so far, the homeless, people who end up in jail because of their mental illnesses or it's correlated in some way, if you could wave a magic wand and fix this the way you wanted to or change the governor's plan, what would you propose?
In order for behavioral health services to really have good outcomes, they need to be accessible and effective. And what I mean by accessibility is meeting people where they're at, not expecting individuals to show up at your front door. It's not enough for a provider to hang an open sign on the door and expect people to magically show up. The populations that we work with typically don't do that. So it's really incumbent upon us to go to them. These are traditionally underserved individuals who faced lots of barriers. So that's the accessibility part, meeting people where they're at, both geographically and culturally, and just knowing where they're at in terms of their recovery. The other part of that, though, is effectiveness of services. So if we think in a broader context and get out of the notion that mental health services is somehow limited to therapy or medication management, and look much more holistically at the individual. Individuals would rightfully be depressed if they have untreated cancer, for instance. It would certainly make me depressed if I had a diagnosis such as that. I've talked to individuals who have very serious medical complications that are untreated because they don't have insurance. So if we can start to coordinate all of those things, get them insurance, address their medical conditions, address their housing conditions, address their vocational or educational conditions, address all of these things, all of these surround in tandem with mental health in a very person-centered way that really respects the dignity of the individual and their ability to make choices, then I think that we could have a very profound impact in serving individuals with severe mental illness.
Some experts say children are the overlooked population for mental health care. Why is that?
In Milwaukee, we have a very good program that the county operates called Wraparound Milwaukee, and it's actually a national model. Children are often covered through their parents' insurance and also through Medicaid. So children who have services at least should theoretically have access to mental health services. The question would be, are they properly being screened for those services, I would think. Does their pediatrician recognize that psychiatric symptomatology and then know to make a referral to a specialist that could treat that? If your primary care doctor, who might have the first interaction with children, or even the parents that are working with them, don't know what to look for and think they're just going through a phase and this is part of growing up, it might make it more difficult to coordinate those services.
What about people who have highly functional mental health needs, who have insurance, a home, a support system? What are or are there barriers that are specific to that group?
Typically, what I've heard from individuals is the difficulty in accessing psychiatry. So individuals, I have heard anyway, it might take up to 6 weeks in order to get an appointment to see a psychiatrist for an evaluation and determine if medication might be helpful. By virtue of that fact, many individuals will end up going first to their primary care physician, who might prescribe an antidepressant or something else. Maybe it will work, maybe it won't. And if it doesn't, then it's just that much longer before they're able to see a psychiatrist. What ends up happening at that point is individuals usually are experiencing a lot of stress as a result of that mental illness. And it's difficult to wait 6 weeks to be able to go see someone, to see a specialist, or to be able to get in to see a therapist, to get an assessment done, to try to find out how treatment can proceed. If your life is chaotic now, it's going to be chaotic likely in 6 weeks from now. It doesn't magically go away, and it might be even worse. And what you often find then is people might need to access urgent or crisis care as a result of that unmet need.
Walter Locks of Community Advocates, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Walter Locks is Director of Behavioral Health Services for Community Advocates. He spoke with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley. If you or someone you know has an untreated mental illness, Locks suggests you check out Mental Health America or the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There are links to more from WUWM.com. We deconstruct headphones, metaphorically anyway, with the CEO of the Koss Corporation. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.